Hello and welcome to episode 264 of the Retro Asylum podcast, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show. And I'm here with Mads. Hello, Mads.
Hello, Chris.
Just the two of us.
Just the two of us.
We can make it if we try. No, this is not karaoke asylum.
No.
But it's game club time. We're here to announce the long list and short list.
Yep.
For the next month for November, and we've got a little guest, not live here with us, but we've done what we did. I think we're getting lazy, Mads.
We are asking
other people to choose our games.
Yeah, that's true. So Raushi picked our last games, and man, what a month it's been. Man, I've been loving playing Maximo.
Did a good job, didn't he?
Oh yes.
Always knew he would.
Mm.
There's been people on Discord saying that he should be a member of the pod. I'm almost scared of that, though, because I think he would just absolutely put us to shame.
Sure.
He knows a lot about games. And he chose well, really well, with Maximo.
Mm.
You enjoyed it?
Oh, I loved it. I mean...
It's great, wasn't it?
Some guys have been complaining a little bit about the camera, but I can't even fault that. There's nothing in this game I didn't love, actually.
I can fault it.
Yeah?
And I will when we talk about it. But really, it's the thing that keeps it from absolute greatness for me.
So there's one part. We'll get into that in the actual episode. There's one part in one of the levels in World 5 where the camera gets in the way. But that's the only place, because all the other places, you can just hold down the... it must be L1 button.
R1.
Then you have something like a follow camera and it just works.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, let's not bolt too early on that one.
But we'll a brilliant, a masterpiece of a 3D platformer action game, if you ask me.
Yeah, completely
wonderful. And the difficulty is spot on. I mean, it's hard, but it's never unfair.
No, and I've got views on that, which I will save. But I think by the end of it, I was pretty sailing through those levels without too much trouble.
Yep.
Besides the coffin bit in World 5, that one of the last levels, there's a section where you have to jump across a poisonous stretch of water with coffins.
Yep. So, I think I died there like 5 times at least.
Yeah, I certainly came a cropper on that bit, definitely. Mm. But anyway, we're here to talk November, not October.
Yep.
So that's what we're going to do. Before we do it, dare I ask, how are you?
So for our listeners, this next section is going to be a bit of a downer. So just skip the next couple of minutes if you don't want to listen to old men rant about how the world is unfair and everything. So, no, I'm bloody horrible, mate. How about you?
Pretty much the same.
Yeah.
We should be looking forward to the Manchester meetup. It's the 26th of October.
Yep.
We should be looking forward to the Manchester meetup on Saturday, you coming over for the first time.
Yeah.
But events conspiring against us.
Oh, yes. So, I've got some trouble with one of my daughters who's got some issues that I need to take care of. And right now, as it is, it doesn't look as if I'm going. But maybe if there's a miracle tomorrow, that's my cutoff day. If there's a miracle tomorrow, things will look up and I will still be traveling to Manchester on Friday, but it's not looking likely right now, mate.
No. And for me, everything was looking good. Woke up yesterday morning on Monday, very positive about the week ahead. And then my son had the cold, woke up with a cold, which not unusual this time of year. My wife being vigilant, done a lateral flow test for COVID. And would you believe it? The first time in the last 18 months of this horrible, horrible illness has been around, it was positive.
Mm.
I couldn't believe it. So we did two more and they were both positive. So once I finished feeling very, very sorry for myself, which it took about 24 hours, we booked ourselves some PCR tests today. So we went along to a drive-through PCR test centre near where we live. And now we anxiously await the results of whether we've... And I think what we've decided, chatting to you about it yesterday, what I've decided is, you know, even if I'm negative, if he or one of the other members of the family are positive, then I will not go, because I think that's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Being in an enclosed space with a bunch of our friends from Discord and in the community is not what I don't want to infect anybody else.
Seems sensible, mate. But a damn shame.
Such a shame.
Mm.
I can't believe it. I mean, of all that, you know, literally for the last 20 months, however long COVID's been around, 20 months now.
Yeah.
We've not even come close to getting it. And we're, you know, we're careful. We're still wearing masks. I don't know where he could have got it. I mean, it must have been in school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a massive shame. You know, sorry for everyone who was coming along. And yeah, I don't think Mads and I will be missed terribly when you're there playing the arcade games and eating curry without us. Spare us a thought if we can't make it. There will be other times, though, mate.
Yes, there will be indeed. And here's hoping for a false positive, mate. It's only the lateral flow test, so they can be wrong. So.
Yeah, I mean, if it comes back negative, I'll jump for joy, and I'm there.
Mm.
I won't go out. And I won't let anybody else go out of this house to bring anything into the house before the weekend. So I am hoping. I'm not confident because he is poorly. He's got cold-like symptoms.
Mm.
So and it feels almost like it's a matter of time before one of us gets it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
With the way the world is, it just happens to be this week, which is really, really gutting.
Mm.
Anyway, there we are. That's our tale of woe.
Yep. Enough sad stuff. Let's get into some of the fun here.
Yeah, let's get positive Peters out of the closet and put away negative Nigels.
So I've got some wonderful news, mate.
Go on then.
So Sarah Jane Avery released the Briley Witch Chronicles. We probably mentioned that in the news section 7, 8, 10 times, something like that.
What are we going to talk about now? She's released it.
Exactly. It's been released. It's wonderful. And it's available right now at sarahjaneavery.itch.io. And of course, it's called the Briley Witch Chronicles, named after her her book series. And it's only $10 is what it's saying here, nothing. For this huge cartridge game. It's a if I do recall correctly, it's a 512K cartridge, so that's pretty
massive.
I think that's the largest size you can get on the C64. And it's an RPG, of course, set in that universe from her books, and you are Briley Forrester and of course her cat. I forget what cat. The cat is called Smokey. Going out to solve some mystery. I forget what's actually going on right now, but I think it's following the what happens in the first two or three books, something along those lines. So it's a Japanese inspired RPG.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Promises dozens of hours of gameplay.
Yep. And of course, it's for the C64. If somebody should have forgotten, yeah.
Mm. This is a big ask, and you probably won't know this, but do you know if there were any games released commercially back in the day that had a cartridge size that big?
No, I don't know. No. I don't know.
I wonder. It makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Would be something like Project Firestart, for example, which was on four full floppies. That could probably have used one of those huge cartridges, but I don't think it had a cartridge release, though.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how she does promise dozens of hours of gameplay in a JRPG. I'm really interested to see what mechanics she's brought to the party to keep us interested for that length of time. So even if it was, you know, 25-hour JRPG would be considered a short JRPG.
Mm, yeah.
And this is essentially a one lady project. She's had some help, I think, with some sprite work. There was somebody on the credits who was mentioned.
Yeah, Paolo Ratchin, I think.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, good man. Yeah, so pretty much one person with some help.
Programming, graphics, and sound, all done by Sarah Jane Avery.
It's very, very impressive.
Mm.
Either way, I can't wait to play. I've been looking forward to this for ages.
Oh, yes. I'm going to buy tonight, I think.
Imagine if it had come out back in the day. Yeah, you know, I always like to think, just imagine if these things had come out back in the day. You know, you wouldn't be able to believe it that something like that had come out. So I've been up to a few bits. I have finally got my Atari 800 XL, which I received from the lovely Mark Billund kit on Discord. few months back now, he sent me a wonderful gift in the shape of an Atari 800 XL, which he got from his friend's cavern of retro gaming that he often talks about on Discord. And for my birthday a couple of months ago, I got one of those, what you call them? The flash floppy things for the...
Call a C-Max or something
that's
Max.
That's it, the S-Max.
S-Max, yeah.
S-Max, isn't it, I think. So, yeah, I decided, because I've reached the introducing Jimmy Marr to the episode, and Jimmy will be featured later, but I've reached this stage in his blog now where he's talking about some early Atari 8-bit games, the likes of Archon and Mule. So I thought this would be, it was whetting my appetite. So I managed to get it, I got it out, got it up and running, got a power lead for it, UK power lead. I plugged in my signal converter to convert the signal from NTSC to PAL. And I have it running nicely. And I was having a little go at Mule last night, testing the water. So I'm looking forward to diving into some Atari 8-bit games.
So why do you need a signal converter? Haven't you got a CRT that supports 60 hertz or...
I have got a CRT that supports 60 hertz, but with the US Atari and my Famicom, I need a... It's a little box, USB box,
okay,
that you plug the composite signal in. Anything that's NTSC that outputs RGB just displays in colour on my CRT TV.
Yeah.
But anything that's a composite input... displays in black and white unless I run it through this signal converter.
So I have the same issue with my smaller CRT, but my BNOs, the MX4200s, just work. So I don't need any converter.
Oh, does it really?
Of any kind, no.
I'm not using my Panasonic at the moment. So I've got the same Panasonic CRT as I think you have.
Mm.
You have a Panasonic,
yeah, a small 14-inch Panasonic, yeah.
Yeah. So I think I have the 24-inch version of what you have.
Yeah.
But that's in the doctors.
Ah, yes, I know.
And this has led me to a huge revelation that I've been terrified of something going wrong with one of my CRTs. I've got a couple of CRTs. I've got a small one, which is about, I think it's even smaller than 14-inch. It's tiny. It's on my desk here. And I've got a big 24-inch Panasonic. And I love my Panasonic, beautiful picture. But my worst fears came to pass because the sound stopped working during Maxima, which I was absolutely gutted about. So I was panicking, thinking, that's it. There's nobody around who fixes CRTs anymore. I just done a very simple Googling. Lo and behold, 5 miles from where I live, in a little place called Rust Hall, there's a guy who repairs TVs. So I called him and said, look, I've got this CRT. I don't suppose you know anybody who fixes them, do you? And he said, well, I'm a man in my late 50s. He said, I started off repairing CRTs. He said, so I know how to fix them.
Yeah.
He said, bring it over.
Cool.
So I took it over, struggled in there from the car to the shop in this massive CRT in my hands. And he sent me an email today saying he's fixed it.
Wonderful.
And he said, actually, there was nothing wrong with it. He said it just needed a good old clean-up inside.
Okay.
He just cleaned up the connectors, and he said it was working perfectly. And he said, I've given it a little bit of a service as well. He said the picture's a little bit clearer now.
Yeah, cool.
So I am very pleased. If there is anybody who is in the southeast of England, I would highly recommend, and he has given me permission to share his details, it's a company called Televid. If you Google Televid, TELEVID.co.uk, he did say if you have some CRTs that need repairing, if you can get them to his shop, he'd be more than happy. And he is very reasonable. I hope he's not listening to this because then he'll probably charge me some more. But he is very, very reasonable. Practically nothing to do what he's done with my CRT.
Mm, wonderful.
So I am I'm very, very pleased with that. Look, good news.
Great stuff, mate. Great stuff. Now we just need to get your arcade monitor fixed as well.
Yeah, so I'm going to ask him about that. I haven't broached that with him yet.
Because
He'd have to come to my house to do that because I don't want to electrocute myself taking it out the cab.
So maybe wait until after you're in COVID isolation then.
Yes, exactly. And I'll pay him first as well. That normally cheers people up, doesn't it? Hey, how's Metroid Dread?
Oh, it's beautiful, mate. I haven't had that much time with it, maybe 3-4 hours, but it's great. It's one of those games where you can really, like playing Maximo, you can really feel yourself getting better for every hour you spend. And it's, I love the control scheme and story-wise, I mean, it's Metroid. It's not really that interesting, is it? It's about the gameplay and the exploration. Mm. Yeah, highly recommended. I don't recommend playing it in handheld mode, though, because it's definitely visuals made for the big screen. So I started out handheld and I was a bit underwhelmed, and then I plucked it into the huge TV and with a good sound system, and all of a sudden it was a completely different game. So I'd recommend playing on the TV, but it's definitely a game I recommend to, if you have a Switch, pick it up, because it's great fun.
Is it tough?
Yeah, it is actually. There are these huge robots that you fight in different parts. I think there are 7 of them, and I've killed 2 so far. They're called EMMIs, and they're quite tough, quite hard to kill. You can only kill them with the Omega Blaster, and if you know your Metroid, you know that that's only available for short bursts of time, short amounts of time. So you need to do something and figure out how to find the Omega Blaster and then kill it. So all of the other times when you have to cross the sections of the level where the EMMIs or the MEs live or walk around, you have to be really, really careful. And if they spot you, you have to run for your life.
Yeah.
And that's good fun. I like that. But it's a Metroid game, mate. It's all about the exploration and And to begin with, I was as I said, a bit underwhelmed, and I was thinking a lot of stuff along the lines of, wow, you know, I've got stuff like Dead Cells and other 2D platformers that do this better, but giving this a bit of time and playing it on the big screen instead, this easily rivals that. It's a great game.
Mm, good. So recommended.
Yeah, highly recommended.
And are you going to upgrade your Nintendo Switch Online subscription to take advantage of the N64 stuff?
Probably, yeah, at some point. But I just heard today, actually, on our Discord forum, that people are complaining about the quality of the N64 emulation. I need to look into that first, I guess.
Yeah, I seen that as well. And then I had a bit of a look on Twitter, and there was one of the Kotaku journalists, I can't remember his name now, he posted a video saying, look, this is nonsense. This is just people hating for the sake of it. Mm. Look, and he did a video, you know, showing he was playing, he had Mario 64 running. And he was saying, look at the lag. He said, look, the N64 isn't known for super responsive controls.
No.
He said, this is absolutely no worse than real hardware.
Okay.
So he poo-pooed a lot of the vitriol. I'm sure, look, everyone has a subjective opinion on this stuff, and I haven't tried it. I did download the update on my Switch this morning, but I've got an N64, so I'm not really too bothered at the moment.
I like the idea of being able to play it handheld.
Yeah, me too. And I want to support it.
Yeah.
So I probably will. I probably will. But and it's not expensive, really, for what it is.
No, not at all. I like the idea of being able to play some N64 titles at the cottage, for example. So I'll probably... Yeah. And as you, I want to support that they are doing something to keep their back catalogue alive.
Yeah. I picked up an OLED Switch.
Yeah, I know.
I probably shouldn't have done that. Because I had to explain to my wife why it was necessary. And, you know, it's quite funny because I've got this... I've been reading a lot of stuff about how delicate the screen is, you know, susceptible it is to scratches.
Okay.
Because I had a screen cover on my old Switch, which didn't look the nicest, but did the trick, because when I took it off, when I packaged it up and put it away in its box, and when I took it off, the screen was absolutely spotless.
Mm.
So it did the trick. But the big selling point about the OLED Switch is obviously the quality of the screen.
Yeah.
And it's almost like looking at a TV with really good quality HDR.
Mm.
So when the screen is dark, it looks off rather than having that kind of grey cast to it, like you see on the old Switch. But I was a bit worried about the screen, so I bought myself a tempered glass screen cover.
Okay. Yeah.
From Amazon, and I'm rubbish putting these things on, because I always get air bubbles trapped underneath.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely useless. But I was very carefully doing it. I actually managed to get it on without... It wasn't too bad. But it just made the screen look rubbish.
That's no good.
Well, I was looking at it thinking, now it probably looks worse than my old Switch. So then I thought, well, why have I bought it? I've got a slightly bigger screen with a screen that looks probably not much better than my old Switch. So I've taken it off again. So now I'm playing it naked screen, which looks beautiful, but I walk around like it's some kind of ancient relic.
You'll get over that soon. As soon as it gets its first scratch, it'll be.
It's not going to get a scratch. It is a. I mean, it does make a difference. I mean, the larger screen is. I mean, it is a big. It feels like a big upgrade. I mean, as I've said to you before, when I think about my Switch, I think, I play it mainly in dock mode. But I think if I was to have a kind of time and motion study, I probably reckon I play about 2/3 I play handheld.
Okay.
Just on the sofa. Mm. So it does feel like a decent upgrade, yeah. But not with a screen protector on.
So on my Switch, I have a screen protector as well. I just have I think Nintendo themselves sell a little screen protector that's just a piece of plastic you glue on top of it. And I can't see it. I can't see that it's there at all.
That's what you need, yeah.
So it's just a small piece of plastic that's, and I probably I'll peel that off at some point and the screen will look pristine, but I don't notice that it's there at all.
Have you not got any air bubbles trapped underneath?
Nope.
See, if we were in Manchester, you could put my screen protector on full. You're obviously good at it.
Yeah.
There we go. We need it to happen. So should we introduce the theme for November then?
Yes, let's do so. I think you should, because it's something we've been wanting to do for a long time. But yes. You had a very special interview recently, and that kind of sparked this idea. So present away, mate.
Yeah. So Jimmy Ma, bringing it back to Jimmy.
Yeah, loved that interview, by the way, mate. It was really great. It made me dive into his back catalog. And like you, I'm stupid, so I need to do stuff chronologically. So I'm a bit more than halfway through his first ebook. I read it on my Amazon Kindle.
Yeah, that's right. Because he's released several of them, hasn't he? Several volumes, putting his blog entries together into an ebook.
12, 15 volumes, lots and lots. I've downloaded them all.
17?
No, 12 or 15 or something along those lines. Okay. I've downloaded them all and put them on my Kindle, so they'll be read when I'm at the cottage.
I love it. Again, these things are obviously not for everyone, but I love how meticulous his research is, his focus on history. He's a bit like me in some ways, or I'm like him. He thinks he's a bit older than me. So I'm like him in that he likes to see how things begin and how things evolve, and I love that. That's why I love retro gaming, because I love to see how we've got to where we are today. And anyone who reads his blog or has listened to the interview will know that he is all about narrative-driven games, plot-driven games, and not solely adventure games. He talks about other games and strategy games, but he loves a plot. That is what he's here for. It's what he games for. So we've been talking about text adventures, interactive fiction now for a long time.
Yes.
And doing it as a theme in the game club. And I know that many of our listeners would like to see us do it. Feels like now that the nights are drawing in and it's getting dark and it's getting cold, now is the time of year to do it. So when I was talking to Jimmy offline after the interview, I asked him if he would be willing to give us 8 games which he thinks are particularly interesting or noteworthy across the history of text adventures that we could put forward to a long list. Now, I didn't hear from him for a few weeks, and I didn't want to press him because he's a busy man. So I was starting to think, he's probably forgotten. But then the weekend, we'd already talked about possibly putting together our own long list for this stuff. But at the weekend, he came off trumps and he sent me an email with 8 suggestions. So I asked you if you'd be willing to discard our previous plans and let's go with this. And you kindly said yes. So that's what we're doing. So the November theme, courtesy of Jimmy Marr, the digital antiquarian, is text adventures.
Yes. Looking forward to this, mate.
So let me read. I'll just read the introduction to his email. What he says is, note that this isn't meant to be any canonical list of the best ever, capital T, capital B, capital E. That is not Jimmy's style or anything. Just some interesting games I enjoyed. I've avoided Infocom and the other big games that everyone knows under the assumption that you do too. Now, that assumption may be misplaced.
Yes.
Perhaps.
So maybe we can revisit this theme in a year or two and then have some of the big hitters, because a lot of our listeners haven't played even the big hitters, I'm sure. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, including this one.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
Yeah. I've played the odd game over the years, and the only text adventure I've ever finished is a recent one.
Okay.
So I need to. It's a genre that I'm just desperate to dive into.
Mm.
Shall we introduce them then?
Yes, let's do so.
Take them one by one.
Sure. You start, because it's your game first.
It's my game. Somehow got a reputation as being my game.
Yes.
So my game, for anyone that has listened to this podcast for any length of time, will might be able to guess, is the precursor to Leisure Suit Larry itself, Soft Porn Adventure. Now, when people think... In fact, let me just read what Jimmy says. Jimmy says about Soft Porn Adventure, which was published by Blue Sky Software in... It was published by Sierra.
It must be published by Sierra. Probably.
Maybe I'm looking at
And developed in-house as well, wasn't it?
It was. It was created by a guy called Chuck Benton.
Okay.
I don't know. Moby Games is leading me down the wrong path. Anyway, Jimmy Maher says, a rare example of a game that's better than its reputation.
Mm.
Chuck Benton's evocation of singles life in the disco era is worth a play, even if the actual game is destined to be eternally overshadowed by that cover art.
And we all know that cover art is what Chris is so endeared with. So, but to be honest, we were talking about before. So kids, close your eyes now. Ears. So they do look rather nice, and it looks like Roberta's got quite a rack. So I understand why you like that cover.
Yeah. Jimmy's entry in his blog on this is really funny. I think the guy in that photograph who's holding the tray,
yep,
looking like some kind of cross between Chuck Norris and John Wayne, is, I'm sure they just plucked him from a nearby restaurant and just said, could you just come and...
Yeah, he's the only one who didn't actually work at Shura. The three girls all work from Shura, don't they?
That's right. They were. There was obviously one is Roberta.
Yeah.
And then there was, I think...
And the receptionist and someone else. I forget who the third one was, I think.
I'm just looking at the box art now, actually. This is for the Apple II version.
Mm.
And it says at the bottom, note, this game is R-rated. It is not suggestive for minors or persons easily offended. It is offered solely for entertainment value. No other purpose is intended or implied by the manufacturer. How 1981.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. For a text game. It's all text.
Well, according to Jimmy, and from his blog entry, which I remember when he read it a little while ago, this is actually not very R-rated at all. In fact, he doesn't think it's barely titillating in terms of... I think Charles Benton on the box. Chuck Benton's skill wasn't really in telling a titillating story. It was more in devising a series of puzzles that were actually capable of being solved.
Yeah.
Remember, this is 1981, the era of Zork, and the early, really early text adventure games, the Scott Adams games and the early high-res adventure games, which were notorious for being very, very difficult.
Yeah.
So what Jimmy said in his blog, actually what's refreshing about soft porn is that it's actually quite enjoyable because it's not as difficult as the others.
Yeah.
Could be a good one,
and
given that we're not text adventure experts.
And the plot is seemingly very similar to Leisure Suit Larry's first outing in the Land of Lawrence Lizards. Sorry.
Pretty much the same. Mm. One guy's quest to get laid.
Yes. To lose his virginity, it even says so.
Yeah, that's right. I think that was embellished, wasn't it, for poor old Larry? So that's his first choice.
Yes.
Soft Porn.
From 1981. And the next game is a year younger, so it's from 1982. It's Transylvania. It's in Jimmy writes here, Penguin's very first adventure game, as well as one of the best examples of the high-res school of illustrated text adventures that dominated on the Apple II during the early 1980s. Antonio Antiochia's homage to the old Universal Monster B-movies is a B-grade gothic delight. That's it, right?
Yeah. Do you know anything about this?
Not at all. I mean, I've read about it now, of course, but I've never heard about it before. So it sounds interesting. It has quite. I've been looking at some of the screenshots for the Apple II version.
Yeah,
it looks quite interesting, actually. I don't know. I'm most text adventures, if not almost all text adventures I've played, haven't had graphics. It's just been me and the text and understanding what's going on, and I actually kind of like that. But the graphics on the Apple II version looks really great as well. So.
It's from that era, wasn't it, where the authors of the games, or in the case of the high-res adventure games, I think it was Ken Williams who did the graphics for most of them.
Yeah,
they look like 12 or 13 year old children's drawings, really, don't they?
I think they're quite good in this one, actually.
But in this one, and this is what Jimmy says in his blog, in this one, and this guy spent months. On these screens, months hand drawing on the Apple II Paint program, hand drawing these screens. And actually, Jimmy says, to his mind, this is the best example in terms of graphical quality on all these early high res type adventures.
Yeah. So in the early, this looks like pixel graphics. It's not actually a vector graphics, is it? Because on the early Shera games, of course, it was a vector drawing that they made there. So that's why it looked so simple, because it was just a number of coordinates and a fill color, and then on to the next part.
It's the same, isn't it?
Is it?
I don't know, to be honest, but it looks the same. Maybe you're right.
It looks more detailed here. It looks like pixel. This isn't vector drawing. Couldn't be.
No, I'm just looking at them. Scrolling through them now. Moby Games, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they're certainly more detailed than Mystery House. Put it that way.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
But I mean, he says that in terms of the literary quality, yeah, like as you'd expect from a 1982 game, it's limited. You know, and the game world is limited. But he's pretty positive about the puzzles. There's no guess the verb puzzles. There's no annoying mazes. I mean, mazes were a feature of these early text adventures. Oh. Love them or loathe them. They're in the vast majority of them.
So mazes I can live with, but guess the verb. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So apparently there's very little of that in this one. The guy was quite young, at least when he started it.
Okay.
Antonio Antioquia. Forgive the pronunciation. Yes. He was young when he started it. I think it took him a while, particularly doing the drawings.
Yeah,
it could be interesting.
Yeah, it looks interesting.
Next one. And this is a game I know very little about. Dragon World, published in 1984 by Tellurium. Jimmy says Tellurium. Moby Games says Trillium.
Yep.
Jimmy says, Tellurium's line of illustrated adventure games based on popular books had its problems, but this is one of the best. Perhaps because a co-author of the book in question, Byron Price, was also the driving force behind Tellurium itself. Now, apparently Dragon World is a series of graphic novels or comics that were published in the late 70s and have, like a lot of these things, have a very avid following. Game was originally published in the Apple II, but it did get ports to most of the home computers at the time, C64, Atari 8-bit, etc. Again, it's a game that has some graphics. Not as much, really, as Transylvania and some of the early Sierra games, but certainly has some still images as you go through. It looks a lot more wordy from the screenshots. I haven't reached this year in Jimmy's blog, so I know very little about this game. But I had a quick scan through, and I think in his opinion, although the Dragon World series is derivative of Lord of the Rings, like a lot of fantasy novels were and are, in his view, the game actually, although it serves as a sequel, I think, to the Dragon World books, and in his opinion, they were the better in terms of the story it tells. Certainly looks like good quality writing from what we can see in these screenshots.
Yeah, indeed.
I don't really know much else about it than that. I mean, is this one that you'd heard of?
Nope. Never heard of it before. I like the looks of it. I like the fact that it's based on a series of books, because that probably bodes well for the writing in there. Because if you're a published author, I'd like to hope that you know how to string a few words together. So it looks interesting, and I love the fact of a game based on some books that I can then try to see if I can find an archive or wherever, and see if I can read some of the backstory.
Yeah, it gives you a wider world to dive into.
Yeah, exactly. I love that.
I'm not massively keen on... I love fantasy fiction. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of Lord of the Rings, etc. And we've spoken about Game of Thrones quite recently and the Song of Ice and Fire books. I'm generally not a fan of derivative fantasy works, though. And I think there are other games on this list which appeal more to me than Dragon World.
Okay.
We'll see.
Yeah. Cool. So the next one on the list is from 1987. It's called Gnome Ranger. So not known, but gnome, like a small goblin or whatever that is. A gnome ranger. It's the second, Jimmy writes, the second level 9 text adventure to use the Chaos system with its active non-player characters who can follow your instructions. Gnome Ranger has some of the most unique puzzle mechanics you'll ever see, and is, in my opinion, level 9's most playable, most soluble, and all-around best game. So did you hear about this before, mate?
I've heard of level 9.
Yeah.
But I don't know this particular game, and I've never heard of the Chaos system.
Nope, me neither. Not sure I've heard of Level 9 either, actually. What have they made that we should know?
So it's a British software house that they did the trilogy of Lord of the Rings games.
Oh, God, they made the worst game ever made for the Amiga.
Go on.
So recently I guessed it on Carl's podcast, the Video Game Newsroom Time Machine. He's got this little segment with his co-host that he calls the 7 Minutes in Heaven. And in the 7 Minutes of Heaven, he chooses a game that is released in the year and the month that he's currently going through with his time machine. And I was in 1991, probably June, I'd like to say. And he picked Champion of the Rosh for me.
I remember that.
That is the most horrible game I've ever been subjected to. The loading times there were so atrocious, and the loading mechanisms were so stupid. I mean, there were two discs, and it would ask me loading just one mini thing, mini game or whatever. It would ask me, insert disc two, load for a while. Insert disc one, load for a while. Insert disc two, load for a while. Insert disc one, load for a while. Insert disc two, and then it would run for 15 seconds, and then rinse and repeat.
Okay.
And apart from that, it was boring. So Champions of the Rosh is made by these horrible, horrible people that I don't want to play their games.
I think you need to be careful of judging all of their back catalogue by that one game. Because they're well known for their Silicon Dreams trilogy. Just looking at their gamography, there was three games, one called Snowball, Return to Eden, and The Worm in Paradise that were released in the early to mid-80s. Now, they are very well known and have a good reputation.
Yes.
So maybe they just lost their way, but I think a lot of these text adventure developers who tried to pivot into the 16-bit era and graphics lost their way, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah.
But
of course, I'm just kidding. This looks interesting.
Yeah, and it got a sequel as well a couple of years later in Ingrid's Back, Gnome Ranger 2. So it obviously sold all right for them to produce another one.
Mm.
Jimmy's praise is good.
Yep, yep.
It's interesting. The next one, Wonderland, 1990. So Jimmy says briefly about Wonderland. Magnetic Scrolls of Swan Song is this fine old school Lewis Carroll pastiche. Mm. And Lewis Carroll pastiche is exactly what it is. Developed by Magnetic Scrolls, published by Virgin Games in 1990 for the Amiga is what I remember it on. I loved Alice in Wonderland when I was a kid. I've read that book many, many times. I remember playing this game on the Amiga.
Yeah.
But back then, I would have been 10, 9 or 10. So I would never have had the intelligence to get through, not without, or the patience, I suspect. But it was designed by a guy called David Bishop, who is well known for loads of games he's designed. Remember Bomboozle on the Amiga?
Nope.
That was a game. So he also did some for Virgin. He did some design support on the likes of The Lion King and Aladdin and Toonstruck.
And he even
designed Peggle, the mobile game Peggle.
I've heard about it. Yes,
which is very good. So Oriental Games, remember Oriental Games on the Amiga?
No.
So he's got a good CV. You know, he knows what he's doing. So Jimmy, in his blog entry, I had a very quick look at it earlier. This is way ahead of where I am.
Mm.
But yeah, again, Jimmy's a bit mixed on the Magnetic Scrolls back catalogue, but he really did like Wonderland, and he says it starts with some nice puzzles which get you into the story, get your confidence up in terms of being able to solve them, and slowly but surely the game just gets harder and harder and the puzzles ramp up, whereas most text adventures that came out in the 1980s start very difficult and just continue to be very difficult.
So this is one of the text adventure games. I've played some of these before. I remember back in the day at some point in the shop where I would always go look at computer games, they gave me a copy of Wizarding 101 Sorcerers Get All the Fun, is that what it's called? And this style of text adventure, where it's actually not, it doesn't feel like you're in a DOS prompt writing stuff. It's a window system. Yeah. So it looks like an old Mac, for example, an old version of Mac OS.
That's right, it does.
Or a very early, like a 2.0 version of Windows.
Yeah.
I thoroughly dislike that style. I don't know why. I really don't like that. I mean, if I'm playing text adventure, I'd like it to be me in the text, and possibly a tiny bit of ASCII like graphics at top. But this there's a text window, and then there's an inventory that actually looks a bit like some icons that you have that you'd have on a desktop somewhere. And then there's some items in this room, you can see them directly there. And then there's a bit of graphics off the side. And possibly even some directional buttons that you push instead of doing north, east, west. It's just never been my jam. But if Jimmy praises this, I'd like to be proven wrong. I'd like to see that this is actually something I'd like to play. For me, it's always been it's been a case of, if you can do all of this, then why don't you do a point of click adventure for me instead?
Yeah, it's almost like a halfway house, isn't it?
Exactly.
Almost like a compromise.
Yeah.
For people who may, you know, maybe they weren't brave enough to make it completely text, but didn't really have the ability to make it into a full blown graphic adventure in terms of the technical.
I guess for me, text adventures need to be from the late 70s or early 80s.
but I also wonder whether, you know, given our community, we have people who would never consider playing text adventures, a lot of arcade game plays, and obviously we've got people who are very experienced text adventure game players. We've got the whole range. I just wonder, choosing something which is maybe accessible is potentially a good idea.
But is it more accessible though? That's what I've always found, that it just becomes more hard for me to navigate. I mean, it's so much easier just to navigate the terminal. But I'm a Linux user and have been for 25 years. I like my terminal.
But I just wonder whether there is, on the face of it, whether people who look at, so they fire up a game like this and they see graphics and they see an inventory and they see animations and stills going on, whether that just makes it feel more accessible.
Yeah, it could be.
I don't know. Possibly. But I like the idea of games which gets progressively more difficult, rather than, you know, if we were to play Zork, for instance, you know, loads of people would turn off because they wouldn't be able to solve. They wouldn't even be able to get into the house. So we want to take people along with us, and I do think there's something to be said for having a game which at least gives people the chance to get into. You know, I don't think we need to gatekeep this stuff or patronize people, but I want as many people playing with us as possible.
Yeah. True, mate. So the next one, the sixth game, is from 1991. We're getting some quite new games here, eh? So that's CosmoSurf. It's Jimmy writes, it's a perfect time capsule of online life circa 1991. CosmoServe is also a great challenging adventure game and the most technically impressive thing ever done with the AGT programming language. So yet another game I've never heard of. It's if you look into Mobi Games, it says it's a single player text adventure about the trials of a software developer. I like the sound of that.
Yeah. And apparently you are RJ Wright, an overtired, undernourished, overeager programmer that's promised to deliver a finished program to a client by 8 tomorrow morning. As a self-employed computer consultant, you're working at home using CosmoServe, your favorite BBS. And it has a built-in BBS simulation complete with sound effects for logging on, switching the computer on and off, etc.
Yeah.
The only game, no, not the only game, one of only two games on this list that wasn't released commercially.
Okay.
Let's say.
Yeah.
So it was authored by a lady called Judith Pintar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming a lady from the name. And it's interesting, right?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
I mean, the good thing, the thing that makes me laugh, I'm looking at ifwiki.org, which I've never really spent much time with. But one of their categories here on the front page, they have a ratings. They have a cruelty scale.
Okay.
So the games are awarded or are categorized by their cruelty, which probably says something about text adventures.
Yes. So how cruel is this, mate?
Well, this one says cruelty to be determined. Now, I assume that means that there's not enough info on it.
Yeah.
But rather than something a bit more esoteric. But yeah, the fact that they do rate these games by cruelty scares me a little.
Yes.
I know very little about this game, like I imagine most of our listeners do. But Jimmy's write-up, A Perfect Time Capsule of Online Life Circa 1991, I am sure would appeal to many of our listeners.
Yep.
Interesting.
Ooh.
Should we move on?
So the next one, speaking of the game I was given for free because they couldn't sell it at the shop, Spellcasting 101, Sorcerers Get All the Girls.
Yeah.
The people who made Spellcasting 101 and Spellcasting 202 and so on and so forth are actually Legend Entertainment. And you are about to present a Legend Entertainment game, aren't you?
Correct. So this is from 1993. It's Legend Entertainment's Eric the Unready, Jibby says. Bob Bates' comic farce about the most inept knight ever. Inept knight, not wizard, because that we all know who the most inept wizard is ever. Rincewind, is both great fun in its own right and a nostalgic treasure trove of early 1990s pop culture. This is a game I most definitely have heard of, and I remember well from back in the day, although I wasn't really a DOS gamer. I joined the PC ranks Windows 95. This only got a DOS release, didn't get ported to, I mean, suppose the Amiga was perhaps a little late to put to port a text adventure to the Amiga.
I mean, 1993, I wouldn't have touched text adventure with a 10-foot pole.
No,
I mean, it's just far too late. Far too late. Mm. And again, it's one of those split into 7 or 8 windows, one with some graphics, one with some navigation, one with the inventory, one with some text that's actually going on right now. This would have scared me away just by looking at the screen.
Yeah. It is one of those like Wonderland OMADs that does have a graphical display.
Yep.
It shows the player's viewpoint in one window.
Yep.
And even there are elements of point and clickness to the game as well.
Mm.
Jimmy is a huge fan. Anyone who's listened to that interview will know that he's got a lot of time for Bob Bates, who designed this game, who gave up, who is very generous with his time to Jimmy in research, when Jimmy's researching these articles. I'm not suggesting that that's influenced Jimmy, but I think it's a big credit to Bob Bates that he does give time to historians like Jimmy. It got great reviews at the time. It appeared on Greatest Games of All Time, Funniest Computer Games, and apparently it does work. The human, I know human's subjective, but apparently it is very funny. This stands out when I seen Jimmy's list. This is the game that immediately stood out to me as one that I would like to play. It's very, Pratchett-esque. He also cites, Bob Bates cited Steve Moretzky as his influence as well, from who we mentioned earlier. So, and Douglas Adams. So it does seem up my street in terms of the humour. It definitely has a Pratchett vibe about it from what I've seen. I'm interested. Colour me interested. This looks good.
Yeah, it does. I'd like to play this as well, because it sounds like something that should be right up my alley, because it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, good fun and the 90s pop culture references, and you say even Pratchett-esque in style, that should be right up my alley. But something just turns me completely off with a 1993 text adventure game with this interface. Man, text adventure needs to be text for me. So I need to be taught differently. This could be a brilliant game, and I'm just looking at it in the wrong way. So I'd actually love to play this. Yeah.
Well, the next one is therefore up your street, even though it's the most modern game on this list. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah. So from 1995, there's a game called Christminster. Yeah. So Gareth Rees' textual interactive conspiracy set. Gareth Rees' textual interactive conspiracy set inside the ivy-covered walls of an Oxbridge college is one of the best cozy mysteries you'll ever play.
Big praise.
Yeah, indeed. It's actually, you told me it was a winner of the IF competition in 1995, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a commercial game. It's just an entry into a competition they had. I mean, these competitions, if I do recall correctly, are still going on. It's been 5, 6, 7 years since I checked it the last time, but there were these yearly competitions of making the best interactive fiction, and there are sites still collecting different games from different authors. So it's very much a scene that's still alive today, the interactive fiction scene.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can read from the official website, the GarethRees.org page for Christminster is still live and looks like a website from 1995. Yep. And his introduction for the game is, when your brother Malcolm sends you a telegram inviting you to visit him at Biblical College, made up, in the ancient university town of Christminster, you imagine that the mysterious discovery he alludes to is nothing more than some esoteric bit of chemistry, and that you'll have a pleasant day out in beautiful surroundings. But when you get to Christminster, nothing is as you expect.
Yep.
Where has Malcolm vanished to? What are the unpleasant Dr. Jarbo and the positively repulsive Professor Bungay up to? And what do long-forgotten alchemical treatises have to do with the modern day?
And this was actually written using the old, the C machine, written in the Infocom interpreter.
Yeah. So we need to download the interpreter, wouldn't we, to be able to run
that? Yeah.
And the only graphics it has is some ASCII art. So there you go. That's more up your street, isn't it?
Yeah, but I need to learn to appreciate the other stuff as well. I mean, it's probably solely because of when it was released, because this was released back when I was playing DOS games, and I looking at those screenshots, I mean, I could be playing Monkey Island 2 that was released the year before, or there's many great point and click adventure games that would just look and feel so much better than this. So that's why I've always shied away from this, but I need to experience some of this stuff.
It's not about the graphics, Mads.
No, that's what I mean. I want stuff without the graphics. Text adventures are about text.
I think it'll be November, with early winter, and Jimmy says it's one of the best cozy mysteries you'll ever play. The cozy mysteries are made for late autumn, early winter months, surely.
So make sure we whittle down this list.
Let's do it.
Oh, and before we do that, let's just, all of our listeners right now who are fretting that, oh man, we'll be playing a text adventure game. That's for nerds. There will be an adventure. There will be an arcade game as well. So you'll be voting on an arcade game as well. Chris and I have chosen each two arcade games. So there will be a vote for those as well. So we have a proper high score challenge.
Yeah. So we're going to have two votes for the first time ever.
Yeah.
two votes. Can you remember what your arcade games were?
Yes, I can. Don't you remember yours, mate?
not right now, but I will find them. I will find them. Are we going to announce those at the end?
Yeah, let's do so. Let's do so.
Go on then. Well, you agonize over your first text adventure choice while I find my arcade game.
So it's been so long since we recorded these because it's been, it's been the RPG month and all that. So do I pick something off or choose something right now?
Choose one.
Okay. Choose one. Oh, that's easy. I'm going to choose Soft Porn Adventure because we've been wanting to play that for so long.
Okay. We have. It feels like we've got to play that, doesn't
it?
Well, it's at least got to be on the shortlist anyway. Okay, so you've chosen the earliest game on the list.
Yeah, I've chosen the semi-naked Roberta. That's what I'm in for.
Yeah, are you hoping that Roberta will grace us maybe with a photo shoot or something for this one?
Probably best not, mate.
she's still a good-looking woman, you know. She must be well in her 60s now. Okay, so you've chosen the earliest.
Yep.
I'm going to choose the most recent. So I'm going to go with Christminster, actually.
Okay.
Because Jimmy completely sold me on that line, one of the best cozy mysteries you'll ever. I'm a sucker for a cozy mystery. Absolute sucker. Give me a Agatha Christie any day. So this sounds right up my street. Mm. And I like the idea of spotlighting, even though it was a long time ago. God, a long time ago. 26 years old, this game. So I like the idea of spotlighting on a non-commercial game. So I am going to put, and I know people are going to look at the shortlist and think, what is Christminster?
Yep.
There you go. Christminster is on the list.
Okay, mate. So I'm torn right now between Dragon World and Eric the Unready. Dragon World because I love diving into a larger universe that's already there. So it would be so much fun seeing if we could find those old graphic novels and reading those before or while playing the game. And Eric the Unready, mostly because I feel like it should be right up my alley, but it's something that rubs me all the wrong ways when I look at the imagery. So I need to learn about these text adventures, these more modern text adventures. I mean, there's got to be something there that I'm not seeing. So this is tough, actually. Nah, I'm going to be hard on myself and go for Eric the Unready.
Good man. I think that's a good choice. So I'm going to be doubly hard on you, and I'm going to choose Wonderland.
Not Dragon World?
No, it didn't appeal to me, Dragon World.
Okay.
I mean, in fact, if I could say probably on this list, the game that appealed to me least was Dragon World.
Well, it's good that it's not in then.
Yeah, maybe I would have been pleasantly surprised, but it just looked a little bit by the numbers fantasy to me, which Jimmy says it's not, and I'll take his word for it. But it did look.
So now we've got two of those horrible semi-graphic multiple window text adventure games,
and they're the two arguably are the most well known. Mind you, Soft Porn is pretty famous as well. So I would reckon that one of those two will get picked. But Wonderland is the only game on this list that I have any kind of nostalgia for. It's the only one that I've ever played. So that's going to sway me. And Magnastic Scrolls are great games, and obviously there's a few of them on the Specky Next as well.
Yeah.
So it might open the door to people going back and playing something like Jinxter or the Pawn as well. Mm. So there we go. Yeah.
So we've got Soft Wonderland. Porn Adventure from 1981. We've got Wonderland from 1990. Eric the Unready from 1993. And Christminster from 1995. It's all wrong in my book. We've got one game from 1981, and then we've got 90s games. We're choosing text adventures, and we've got modern games. It's weird.
Now, mate, they are text adventures.
Of course they're text adventures. They're just not, you know, the canonical text adventures. I mean, they're not the adventures that kind of spawned this kind of game, this era of gaming. They don't represent text adventures.
But our listeners will appreciate the graphics. You do realize that, don't you?
Yeah.
They'll thank us for this. Yeah.
So I hope they thank us by choosing Soft Porn. So choose Soft Porn. Thanks.
So I found my arcade games.
Yep.
Shall we announce what they are?
Yeah, let's do so. You can okay. give first. Us one, and I'll give you one as well.
Okay. So when I got my arcade cab, the first game I fired up and spent quite a bit of time on was a Metal Slug, the original Metal Slug. And whenever I play Metal Slug, I get intrigued about playing one of the earlier NASCAR games, which is In the Hunt.
Yeah.
From 1993, I think.
Was it In the Hunt? Was that actually released before Metal Slug?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah. I thought that was just right after. Okay.
No, I'm pretty sure it was released before Metal Slug. I'm sure it was 1993. But it shares that art style. I can't even describe how would you describe the Metal Slug art style? It's I don't know, stylized. It's got that kind of almost like a robo-punk aesthetic.
It's for me, it's just this crazy, crazy amount of animation frames in a pure 2D pixelated graphic style. It's amazing what they did. And also, the mighty Neo Geo had a hard time actually coping with what they did. There's a lot of lag in Metal Slug games because of all the sprites.
Well, In the Hunt, as far as I'm aware, didn't get a Neo Geo release. It was an arcade only then got a port. This is all from memory, so it could be wrong.
No, the Neo Geo is an arcade board made. It's a Neo Geo MVS board, right?
It didn't get an AES release.
No, but the MVS has lots of lag. If you ever played the original MVS cartridges, I did in my machine, of course. I used to have the original Metal Slug 1, 3, 4, and X, I think. And they've got lots and lots of lag on the original arcade hardware.
Yeah. Well, the only home console port that this got, I'm pretty sure, was a PS1 release.
Yep.
And about 1996. But it's very similar. It's very similar graphic style. Lots going on. It's a shooter. It's an underwater shooter where you are a sub and you are playing through levels. And I've only had a brief go at it. And it plays really, really well. It's as hard as masonry nails, this game, as you would expect from the creators of Metal Slug. But my God, does it look and sound beautiful. And I think it'd be great to really get into it and to try and get half good at it.
Yeah, for some strange reason, I've never played it. I've known about its existence for many, many years, and I love the Metal Slug series. But I've never played In the Hunt, so yeah, I'd like to try that.
Yeah. Yeah, there we go, In the Hunt.
So speaking of shooters, I've went with a Bullet Hill shooter, mate. I wanted to go with one of the early Bullet Hill shooters by Torplan. We've played some stuff like Don Apache, for example, which was a cave shooter, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
So Torplan is the other huge company that makes a lot of Bullet Hill shooters. And I think Batsugan, which is the one I've chosen, is one of the earlier releases, isn't it?
I think it's recognized as the first Bullet Hell game, isn't it?
So Batsugan is another shooter that I've never spent enough time with, but I've loved the little that I've played with it. So it's a 1993 arcade blast, and it's a brilliant Bullet Hell shooter. So I'd love to spend some more time and learn those patterns.
Nice. It's a good game. Mm-hmm. When we played the Donpachi, I was reading about the history of Bullet Hell shooters and went back and had a crack at Batsugan. And it obviously lacks some of the fidelity of the later Bullet Hell games. But yeah, I think the DNA is there for all to see. And it played really well. It's a really good shout. Okay, so my second and final choice. I'll go straight to a short list here. My second and final choice, Crazy Taxi. A positively modern
that's a modern
arcade game,
mate. Game.
It's what?
Yeah, I'm just saying that's a modern game.
It's pretty much, well, in arcade parlance, 1999 is modern, isn't it? So it was, it was released by Sega, published by Sega in 1999, and then got a very famous port to the Dreamcast in 2000. It was pretty much the point when arcades and consoles met, almost, isn't it? That is the maybe late 90s, but that is the point at which they converged in terms of fidelity and quality.
For me, Crazy Taxi will always be a Dreamcast game.
Yeah, and me. I've never played it in the arcade, but I've played it many, many times. In fact, for me, it's probably a PS2 game.
Okay.
That's where I really played
it. I didn't even know it had a PS2 release.
I didn't have a Dreamcast back in the day, but it ended up coming out on GameCube and PS2 and PC, and it's obviously spawned a huge series. But I'm talking about the original arcade version of Crazy Taxi. I feel I do remember playing this
in a stand-up cab, but with a steering wheel and the pedals everything. Yeah.
It's got a great soundtrack by the likes of Bad Religion are on it.
Yeah.
It's just so playable.
Oh, yes. And that's full of punk music, that's right. Offspring as well.
Yeah, Offspring are on the soundtrack. Yeah, all kinds of, it's great music. And that concept of picking passengers up, taking them to places, obviously then ended up in the likes of the GTA games, the modern GTA games. They've all got that sub game where you can go and do that. And that all started from Crazy Taxi. And I imagine now that racing against the clock, seeing how much money, great for a high school challenge, how much money can you raise in a single run or series of runs? I think we'd have a really good laugh playing Crazy Taxi. And the guys who are in Manchester at the weekend, if you find a Crazy Taxi cab, imagine get a few people around that, you'd have a good time.
Yeah. So you are going forward in time, I'm going backwards in time. So my last choice is a true retro game from 1983. It's Tapper. It's a game I played a lot on my C64, and I've always loved playing Tapper, but I've never really spent a lot of time with the arcade game. So I thought that would be perfect for a high school challenge to play some Tapper. So Tapper, everybody knows, I guess, the classic.
I've never played it.
Seriously?
Any version of it, no.
Okay.
I know of it.
Okay, you know of it. Yeah. So you have four bars that you're tending to. You have a beer tap, so you're filling up your beer. You have to satisfy all the customers, and the customers are moving from the left to the right. If they get all the way to the right of the bar before you give them a beer, they'll be angry and you'll lose. So you need to fill the glasses, slide them over the bar to the customers. Yeah. They'll drink the beer and then they'll slide the glass back. So while you're filling glasses to satisfy new customers, you need to catch those glasses that are sliding back as well so they don't break. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And it's...
It sounds very good.
Yeah. I've always loved playing Tapper, but I've never really spent enough time with the arcade version. So I love that for an arcade challenge.
It sounds like a proper classic arcade game.
It is. It is indeed. And it's, of course, it's an old belly midway classic. So one of the big guys.
Yeah. As you say, proper classic from the golden age, that one. So there we go then. There's the four. So we've got In the Hunt, we've got Crazy Taxi, we've got Batagon, and we've got Tapper. Yep. They are the four arcade games. And now let's see if we can remember the text adventures. We've got Soft Porn, Wonderland, Eric the Unready, and Christminster.
Well done, mate. I couldn't have done that.
Now, how is poor Dean? So it's the 26th. We need to pressure poor Dean into getting us a cover so we can get this published, hopefully, tomorrow to give people a reasonable amount of time to vote before the end of the month. So, Dean, if you're listening to this, we are very sorry. We always are.
Yeah, just use the cover from Soft Porn. Everything will be good.
He could do, couldn't he? Do you think he'd have ways to lower the water level a little bit?
We'll have to ask him.
So there we go, mate. Two votes. This is a first. We're constantly reinventing our wheel, and those two votes will be live very soon. And then I've been doing lots of research because I finished Maximo quite early, so I've actually been doing quite a bit of research for our Maximo episodes. I'm looking forward to that. We'll have to get that. Maybe we could use our what's likely to be our leisure time at the weekend, unexpected leisure time, to hopefully find some time to record a Maximo episode.
Yes, let's do that.
Might be nice. Good. Well, that's us for this shortlist episode. We'll get this out to you guys as soon as we can. Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Dean. And Mads and I will be back talking Maximo very, very soon, won't we, mate?
Yes, we will. Really looking forward to that.
Until then. Signing off. Have a good one. Take care, everyone.
Take care.
From now on, unlike your parents were, you are the secret force of Retro Asylum.
Playing so fast, they're the only ones who can take you back in time. They play old games, they're more retro than J1 Optimus Prime. At home or the arcade for adventures.